Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden, and I'm joined in the studio tonight by tonight's co-host, retired San Francisco attorney David Begelizen.
Tonight, we are in the second part of a series on immigration. We will be talking about the conflict between general humanity, ordinary humanity, versus the system that our government is imposing upon people whom they seek to deport.
Just over a year ago, we dared ask such questions as, what is it going to take before Congress will take up a fair and just immigration system? Since that time, it seems the situation's worsened. We asked, when somebody shows up at the border claiming asylum, does the system give them the benefit of the doubt? And if not, why not? Again, is there a change for the better? Tonight we ask, isn't the fight for immigrant and refugee rights a forgotten part of the race, of the fight for social justice?
Just a minute here. Okay. And we have a great deal to discuss here. Bill, why don't you introduce Bill Hing, and then we'll get started.
And as always, there's much to discuss. You can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. We're talking immigration. We're talking about the raids that are going on right now. We're talking about what you can do if ICE agents show up at the court. You're not limited to the exact point we may be in our conversation. Our phone number right here is 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. Come on, we have wonderful guests, but our most important guest is you. We'd like you to come and join in our conversation. Joining us tonight, Professor Bill Hing founded the Immigrant Legal Resource Center in 1979 and served as a volunteer executive director for its first two decades. A professor at the University of San Francisco School of Law, he's the author of at least 14 books, including most recently, Humanizing Immigration, How to Transform Our Racist and Unjust System. And it just doesn't seem to be changing for the better in recent weeks. An expert in immigration policy, negotiations, public service strategies, Asian American legal history, Bill Hing is a professor at the University of San Francisco, where he serves as professor of law and is the founding director of the Immigration and Deportation Defense Clinic. So when we started the series 2 weeks ago, we had an idea that things were up. We knew that the immigration system needed a lot of work. We knew that at least certain people, a certain sector of our leadership, was going to use immigration as the wedge issue to try to divide us. But was it in any way foreseeable the extent that things would turn? What appear to be riots forming and having National Guards and the military turning out in major cities across the country? Yes, the most extreme was in Los Angeles. It appears to be the first. I'd like to update our chat with what's been going on. First, we have a caller who I'll put through. This is Lorenzo from San Lorenzo. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you for taking the call. I just have a quick question. You mentioned resources, and my question is, if somebody came to this country on a visa, but the visa expired and they stayed, do they have more opportunity to get resources than somebody that snuck through the desert under the cover of night and just stayed here after that and came in without any permission ever?
Before I turn that question over to my guests, I'm going to ask you to clarify a little bit about what you're asking. Are you talking about who's in a better place to get relief, or are you talking about who might find more folks out there to help? Exactly what is it you're trying to ask?
Yeah, kind of both. If they are, like, Manny came in here in in the 90s. His visa expired, and in 2008, he's been here productive illegally, but working and paying taxes since forever. And it's been 10 years, 15 years. Is he going to have more opportunities, more people to help him, more avenues to get relief on his immigration status than, say, somebody that came here from wherever? They could come from, there's 100+ countries that came through the southern border last 5 years, whatever. And they just came here illegally, paid a coyote, and they're here from wherever. They're not a terrible person, just somebody that never had legal immigration status when they came to the country. And are they shut off from a few of those avenues, but they still have things open to them? It's just a little harder, or are they both of those people on even footing?
It sounds to me like you're really asking two discrete questions. Let me break them down a little and then pass them along to our guest. The first question really talks about whether somebody who's here for a lot longer may find more folks willing to help. They know the agencies to go to, or maybe there are more agencies available to him or her. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's what I was asking.
Well, this is Bill Hing. First of all, that person that you're positing, it depends on the circumstances. You know, has a person ever had a criminal conviction? Is a person married to a U.S. citizen? Does a person have any U.S. citizen children? That kind of thing. So it depends on the facts. But the answer to your question is that it's possible that that person has more avenues for relief. But it may not be, and so it kind of depends on the facts. The second set of individuals that you're talking about, I wouldn't just summarily dismiss those individuals as your question suggests, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but your question sort of suggests that the qualities or the facts in that person's background may not be that sympathetic, but I would say it depends on the facts. If that person had a relative or a sibling or a spouse that just got murdered by a gang or by the political government from which they fled, then that person's situation might have a lot of sympathies. I actually don't want to compare those two individuals. But again, whether or not either one of them has an avenue for relief depends on the facts of the case. In terms of, I think what your second question is do community-based organizations or immigration lawyers discriminate against one set of individuals versus another set of individuals? Not really. It depends on where those organizations get their grants from, what their funding is for. Some organizations are funded specifically for representing people facing deportation. Other people are funded specifically to represent children. Other organizations are funded to represent people from different political situations. So it kind of depends. Private immigration lawyers who are paid a fee, they'll probably represent either person if those individuals have the fee to pay for them. So there's not a black and white answer to your question. It depends on the circumstances.
That said, would somebody who's been here, is there a period of time after which they're presumed that maybe they have some rights, or is it more how engaged they are? Do they have family here now, that type of thing?
That's a good question, Jeff. There is an avenue of relief called cancellation of removal for someone who has lived here for at least 10 years and is a person of good moral character namely that they haven't had any problems with the police, and they can demonstrate a very high level of hardship that would be visited upon a citizen child or a citizen spouse and or a citizen parent. And that's a hard relief to get. But after you've lived here for 10 years, if you're put in removal proceedings, you can at least apply for that. So again, yeah, it depends on what the facts are and the circumstances. But I know many people who get denied cancellation, even though they've lived here for 15, 20 years, and they have healthy U.S. citizen children, they get denied relief, and they get deported.
Let me jump to another caller. We have Robin from Alameda on the line. Thank you for waiting. You're on the air. Welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. I'm confused about the due process. I thought everybody got that and was able to present their case to a court. And the judicial system that you've described sounds very complicated. Is it that authority is the immigration court, or do they, and does everyone have access to that when ICE picks them up? I wish you could clarify the determination of due process in this case. Thank you so much for your program.
Let me ask you a question real quick before you go away. Are you asking about what the law says and what's been the case up until maybe 6 weeks ago? Or are you talking about what's happening right now? We may have two different answers.
I see. Okay. I was told by a former judge that due process is really much more flexible a term than what I understood from my high school civics class. I thought everybody had to go, was allowed to go to a court and to a judge and present their case, everyone from the 14th Amendment. And what he says is that it depends on the situation under, I guess, these particular circumstances, and I don't understand which circumstances trigger that variability.
We're talking about an immigration area, and due process is quite different. So don't think of due process in immigration the same way that you would think in criminal court. In criminal court, irrespective of your immigration status, incidentally, you have a right to a jury. If you want one, you have a right to an attorney that's appointed for you, and you have a right to appeal, and you have a right to an interpreter. You have a right to not be tried, for example, if you don't understand the nature of the proceedings. Everything that I just said does not apply in deportation proceedings, and that's under the Immigration and Nationality Act. So Congress defines, in the first instance, how much due process is afforded for somebody facing removal. Here's one fact that will shock you. If you have lived here for less than 2 years, you do not have a right to a hearing in front of an immigration judge. You are subject to something called expedited removal. So if you've lived here for less than 2 years, you don't even get a right to a hearing in front of an immigration judge, much less a right to an attorney or a right to a jury. None of that if you've been here for less than 2 years.
Bill, how can I show that I've been here for more than 2 years if the government says I haven't been here for more than 2 years?
Yeah, so we advise folks when we give community presentations to literally keep a file at home of their PG&E bills or their kids' school records, your lease for your home, to keep a file folder of information that you've lived here for more than 2 years, and hopefully you'll have a chance to produce that. You can't carry that around with you, but that's what we advise people to do.
Who do I show it to?
You show it to an immigration agent if they give you that opportunity. And so here's the thing. If they don't believe you, David, your question is a good question, because if they don't believe you and there's no one around to help you, you could be on the next flight to a detention center from San Francisco to Louisiana, where you basically have to fend for yourself. And so you're right. There are unscrupulous ICE agents that you might not have a chance to produce that evidence that you've been here for more than 2 years. Assuming you have been here for more than 2 years, you do have a right to a hearing, to the caller's question, before an immigration judge. Let me point out, though, that many ICE agents, one of the first things they do is present you with a waiver, a form for you to sign that waives your right to a hearing. Many people don't understand what is happening. Many people are presented that document in English, and they don't read or write in English. And so I have met many individuals who signed that waiver form not knowing that it was a waiver form. Assuming you don't sign that waiver form, you have a right to a hearing before an objective immigration judge. You do not have a right to appointed counsel. You don't have a right to a jury. It's only the immigration judge, who is not a federal judge appointed by the president. They are federal administrative law judges. They answer to the attorney general. They are part of the Department of Justice. They're not a separate entity that's part of what we call Article 3 of the Constitution. They're not Article 3 independent judges. They're administrative law judges that work for an agency, namely the Department of Justice. And so they hold a hearing. They take evidence, and most individuals do not have an attorney when they're represented. And so folks are left to fend for themselves. In San Francisco, more than half of the people who show up at hearings are represented. But that's because we have a lot of community-based organizations and a good pro bono philosophy of private immigration lawyers. And but even then, I would say that a third of people who appear in immigration courts in San Francisco are appearing without representation.
Gosh. Well, I am shocked, and thank you so much for clarifying things. It helps.
You know, that brings up a question I have. Years ago, I had some minimal exposure to administrative law, and it seemed that at that time, it was pretty easy to get a hold of records. So you know the hearing officer you're going to appear in front of, the administrative law judge, has this one as a 30% rate of overturning the agency. This one is more like 65. Are those records readily available for immigration law judges? And is there any danger that the Justice Department will say your numbers are too high, we're going to retire you?
That's an excellent question. And the answer is yes and yes to your two questions. You can look up an immigration judge's asylum approval rate. You just Google it. Google the name of an immigration judge, and it'll lead you to a website that's sponsored by Syracuse University. It's called, the acronym is TRAC, T-R-A-C, stands for Transactional Resource something. And it'll give you every immigration judge in the country and what their asylum approval rate is. And so the lowest that I've ever seen is 1% approval rate, okay? And that was a judge in a detention center in Stuart, Georgia, okay? There are some immigration judges who have a 90% approval rate. Even in San Francisco, the approval rates range from somewhere around 30% to 90% in the immigration court in San Francisco. So you'll know going in what the chance, you can know what the chances are. What was the second part of your question, Jeff?
Are they at risk for a Justice Department official saying,
oh, yes,
new law, new policy,
no,
your numbers are too high?
They're at risk for scrutiny. So under Trump 1, the agency had goals that you could not be – first of all, you had to make a decision within 100 days of the case. The second thing was that if you had a reversal rate of 15% – at the Board of Immigration Appeals, you're in trouble. And how that got manifested is that they often transferred people to roles that had no jurisdiction over cases. And most recently, the very first thing that the Trump administration did with the immigration court is they fired everybody who... it wasn't based on approval or denial rates. Anyone who had been an immigration judge for less than 2 years was determined to be on probation. And so they let every probationary immigration judge across the country, they let him go, which is kind of crazy because then that exacerbated the backlog in the immigration court. So, yes, there will be scrutiny of the immigration judges, and there'll be pressure on them to get in line with what the philosophy of the administration is, which is to deny asylum.
Which is basically to say that people who weren't born here are the problem, and they're the reason for all the problems in the country, and create a scapegoat.
Absolutely. I think the non-citizens are the enemy of this administration.
And this administration, at least the president himself, has publicly said on occasion he wished that he could deport citizens.
Well, you know, that's actually not funny, and I don't mean it that. I actually think that they are still talking, the administration is still talking about transferring U.S. citizen prisoners to another country, having nothing to do with immigration, just paying another country to detain people who have been convicted of crimes in the United States. And I do think that that was spoken of seriously between President Bukele of El Salvador and Donald Trump.
Well, now that we're talking about that, and speaking of President Bukele and Mr. Trump, there's now been discussion about transporting people who've been deported to Guantanamo. What can you tell us about that, Bill?
Well, from day one, the threat of housing and detaining individuals at Guantanamo was put on the table by the administration, and it doesn't take the listeners much to research the conditions that existed at Guantanamo during the war with Afghanistan and the war on terrorism. And they have, in fact, sent some detainees, some people who have been arrested, not ordered deported yet, actually, but people who are deportable, allegedly. They've sent them to Guantanamo, but it's become very costly. It's costing somewhere of tens of thousands, if not more, of dollars just to detain each individual there. And the immigration attorney who's the supervisor and the director of the deportation clinic at the law school, and I, Jacqueline Brown, and I, we've signed up, incidentally, that as soon as we have an opportunity, we'll represent people who are at Guantanamo, because we believe that those folks, and this is to the second caller's question, they're going to be deprived of the due process if they don't have volunteer attorneys. And so we are on a list of attorneys who have volunteered to represent people in Guantanamo if they start having hearings there, which I think they plan on doing that. But then they've now transferred a handful of them back to the United States. And I don't think the administration knows what it's doing when it comes to Guantanamo. And that's why they have been talking about other countries. And that's why they manifested their policies with deportation, with detentions in El Salvador.
Can we change the subject and talk about something that I'm sure almost all of our listeners have been thinking about, and that is the most recent raids in Los Angeles, what brought them about, and the government's reaction to it?
You know, I just, it's a shame what's happening in Los Angeles, and it got manifested, the raids got manifested in different ways. One was going to immigration courts and representing people who are following the rules and going to their hearings and getting arrested in the hallways of the immigration court in San Francisco, in Los Angeles, even though they had to show up and they've been part of the system. And they're not been hiding. Then the raids in the communities in Los Angeles, that came as a big surprise because they actually went into neighborhoods and, yes, they had a list of some people that were deportable, but they started asking neighbors and coworkers at different sites for their immigration status. That was purely based on racial profiling. And so the community was up in arms when they found out. They went to a Home Depot parking lot in that area, and it was purely based on racial profiling, and that's a no-no. ICE is supposed to get warrants if they're going after somebody with specific names or a specific business that they have reason to believe that they're hiring undocumented workers.
And if you look at the Department of Justice website, they will volunteer that they went looking for specific people, that they had warrants for certain individuals. What they don't volunteer are the collateral casualties because they knocked on neighbors' doors. They're not volunteering the fact that they're showing up at an employer saying, we want to examine all of your I-9 certificates. And suddenly people are going to work and finding there's ICE agents there who are randomly grabbing people.
Absolutely. And so that's why the community's up in arms. That's why there have been protests or lawsuits filed challenging the profiling that's going on. And my understanding of what happened, and people can correct me here, is that it didn't get violent, that it remained peaceful. But then when law enforcement was introduced into the mix, then there was violence. And I'm repeating what Mayor Karen Bass said. She had to declare a state of emergency, I guess,
curfew.
Last night. Curfew. And it's too bad because the violence was fomented and exacerbated by the introduction of troopers, the National Guard. And there's a question over whether or not the president had the authority to do that. And Governor Newsom, I understand, is filing a lawsuit challenging that.
That lawsuit got thrown out yesterday.
Interesting. And so if the president can get away with that, and then now we know that Marines are being dispatched to the area, it's a military zone.
And he's using the National Guard. We understand the use of the military to protect government buildings. We understand the use of the military to stop attacks on government workers. But they're using the National Guard, as of today, to send them in to escort ICE workers so they can go wherever they want, knowing that they've got military support behind them.
Yeah, and that's very questionable because, as we all know, the military is not supposed to be engaged in domestic work. They're there for our federal defense. And the first night of the actions by ICE, LAPD, I believe, made a mistake. LAPD was called in to protect ICE, and they felt that they needed to do that because ICE pleaded that their lives were in danger. And so LAPD felt that as long as they weren't helping ICE carry out immigration enforcement and just protecting ICE from bodily harm, that LAPD was doing the right job. Well, there's no way to distinguish between helping protect ICE from bodily harm and helping ICE arrest somebody. And I want San Francisco residents to understand that the San Francisco PD has a very similar policy that it is in their sanctuary department governmental order, that if ICE calls SFPD up because ICE is afraid that they're going to be hurt, SFPD has a carve-out to the sanctuary ordinance that SFPD can go and protect ICE. And I hope we don't reach that point. SFPD has been cautious. They've made some arrests, but it's for violating for blocking intersections, that kind of stuff, and not when ICE is around.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We'll be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's lawyer referral service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616 or visit sfbar.org for more information.
So I've had a question posed to me to pass along, and that is, what is ICE What's motivating ICE to show up in courts, whether it's the state court where somebody is dealing with their own proceedings, whether it is the immigration courts in particular, and targeting immigrants who are having their day in court?
I don't think I'm being simplistic in my answer. The motivation is Stephen Miller. Listeners may recall, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, that he urged the firing of a couple of high ICE officials because they were not deporting enough people. They were not arresting enough people per day. He demanded that there be 3,000 ICE arrests per day. And at the time he fired those folks, the arrests were somewhere around 1,000 or maybe 1,200 a day. So the marching orders were clear. Do everything that you can to find people that are that aren't lawful in the United States. And easy targets are people who already are in the immigration system that are facing deportation. Many of them were paroled into the United States by the Biden administration in order for them to be able to apply for asylum. And so they were already known, but they weren't in detention. Now they can be detained. Even if their case isn't dismissed, they can be detained according to their theory. Some cases, the judges have cooperated. The immigration judges have dismissed the deportation hearing and allowed those people to be fair game, especially those, as I said earlier, who have been here for less than 2 years. If the judge dismisses their case, those folks are deported because they've been out here for less than 2 years. Those who have been here or the judge has not terminated proceedings, they can still be detained according to ICE's position right now because they came in, they're undocumented, and we can detain them. And so, and then when they believe that there's somebody who is not a citizen facing a criminal charge in state court, then they are going to state courts, or at least they're waiting outside, they're looking at the court calendars, and they're engaging in racial profiling, and somebody with a Spanish surname, they're going to ask them what their immigration status is after a plea bargain, for example. And so what's motivating it is the goal of arresting 3,000 people a day. And we've seen that state court judges in Wisconsin and Michigan have gotten in trouble for allegedly informing defendants who are not citizens that there's an ICE agent in the building.
Bill, maybe we should segue now to the relationship between criminal cases and immigration cases. What effect does a criminal case have on someone's immigration status and his availability to stay in the United States if he's not a United States citizen?
Yeah, every non-citizen in the United States is subject to deportation if they've been convicted of certain crimes. Some of this language that I'm using is technical, and they're defined in the Immigration and Nationality Act. One term is something called an aggravated felony, and there's examples given in the statute of kidnapping, murder, rape, that's listed. But then there's a catch-all at the end of the definition of aggravated felony, and that is, or anything else that we deem to be an aggravated felony. And one example of that is somebody who's been convicted of a crime that involves moral turpitude, which is another definition that we need to look at in the statute. But it can't be petty theft. For example, theft crimes are deemed moral turpitude crimes. Drug charges are usually moral turpitude crimes. And those folks can be deemed an aggravated felon if their conviction, if their sentence is 1 year or more. And so you can have something that's relatively minor that you get sentenced to a year, and that might be an aggravated felony. If you have two moral turpitude crimes, that can also lead to deportation, and that can be two petty thefts. Another example is somebody who is convicted of sale of narcotics. that only takes one conviction usually. And so if you're a non-citizen and you're convicted of something that's deemed a couple of moral turpitude crimes, a drug conviction, or an aggravated felony, you're in trouble. And so it's given rise to a whole field of law that many of us call criminal immigration or crim-im, where you need a specialist before or after the actual plea bargain, for example, because most criminal cases are resolved with a plea bargain. And so you need to have adequate criminal defense to see if your guilty plea is immigration friendly or not, or after the fact, you have to determine whether or not you can engage in post-conviction relief to try to set aside that conviction.
And I want to jump in with a couple of points real quickly. The first is, you mentioned aggravated felony as a term of art. Our listeners have a pretty good idea of what it means, what's a felony as opposed to a misdemeanor, an infraction, some lesser variety of criminal act. But when you speak of aggravated felony, it's not necessarily something that we would think of as that harsh, or certainly doesn't have to be a felony under state law.
That's absolutely right. This example is a Texas example, but I have on record a Cambodian construction worker who was, this is unbelievable. He was working on a construction site, and he was caught urinating on the construction site by a Houston police officer, and he was cited for public urination, put on probation, and a couple months later, he did the same thing. He was caught, but because he had a second misdemeanor under Texas law while he was on probation, it became a felony. That Cambodian was deported because that second public urination evolved into what was labeled an aggravated felony. And so that's one example. Yeah.
I'm thinking of a different part of the law in that regard, and that is sometimes the client will come to his criminal defense lawyer, and the lawyer will say, oh, you have nothing to worry about. The case that you're accused of violating is a misdemeanor. It's not a felony. You're not going to be deported. But in fact, under the specific requirements of the immigration law, it's categorized as an aggravated felony. How often does that come your way?
Often. I would say if I were in the practice of regularly speaking to folks about their plea bargains, I would say that probably happens every day. That unfortunately, many criminal defense attorneys are not aware of their obligations under a Supreme Court case called Padilla versus Kentucky that was decided either in 2010 or 2012. And the Supreme Court recognized that immigration is such a complicated area that for a criminal defense attorney to provide adequate representation for a non-citizen, they actually have to consult with an immigration lawyer or refer the person to an immigration lawyer for adequate advice on whether or not a contemplated plea deal might lead to deportation. But that doesn't get registered with many criminal defense attorneys.
Usually those that are affiliated, whether they're a public defender, whether they work with a panel of attorneys that does conflicts, or whether they work with panel of attorneys that do the indigent defense, like the private defender in San Mateo County, they're afforded tremendous resources in this regard to get those consultations. But those in private practice exclusively who haven't been exposed to that often don't. I've got a third case now against a particular lawyer. I won't mention names, of course, but here in the Bay Area, that routinely pleads people out, does not get any type of consultation, usually sends other people in to appear, and I'm in the process of unwinding one of those pleas.
Absolutely. I'm not surprised. And I'm disappointed, of course, but I'm not surprised, Jeff, that you're running across that. And you're right. Public defender's offices, at least the ones I'm familiar with here in the Bay Area, they're well-equipped. They have staff attorneys that are immigration attorneys. And you're right. In San Mateo County, they have a person that I know who it is who's available for consultations to that service, who get the referrals. And so, but I shudder to think about some defense attorneys who really are not aware of their obligations.
If someone has a criminal conviction, are there any avenues for relief under the immigration law?
Not if it's an aggravated felony. The only relief available for somebody who is an aggravated felon is something called protection under the Convention Against Torture. And that's a very high standard. You've got to show that you're going to be tortured. And so usually what you try to do in circumstances like that, you can't rely on the immigration law. Mm-hmm. You try to go back to somebody like Jeff and get post-conviction relief, and you hope that you can establish the fact that when that person pleaded guilty, they were unaware of the immigration consequences, and you try to get it set aside. I think it's PC 1437.7 to make a motion to set aside that guilty plea.
And there's really two prongs to that, two bites at it you get. One is if they weren't adequately advised and the attorney didn't live up to their standards. They didn't tell the person not only generally this is a bad crime, but given their status, you've been here so many years and you are a green card holder, you are a permanent resident, so this is how this will affect you. The other avenue to get in is if subjectively you can show that at the time of the plea, the person just didn't know. And here they are getting stuff in the mail from ICE. We'd like to have an interview with you. 10, 15 years later, and they just didn't understand the ramifications at the time. If you can get that across, that's a second bite at the apple.
Yeah, that's great. We'll say one other thing that's relevant to all this is that under California law, the district attorney has an obligation actually to also keep in mind the potential immigration consequences of a plea bargain. Now, my understanding, I'm not a criminal defense attorney, is that district attorneys interpret that obligation differently, that there are some that really affirmatively work with the public defender to meet justice, that they get their conviction, but it's for a section of the statute that's not immigration, that it is immigration friendly. But other district attorneys just feel that they can give that obligation lip service. And so, but I do want to point that out, that under California law, the district attorney is supposed to also define justice in a manner, in my view, that can manifest itself in a way that avoids deportation for the person, and the public still gets what it needs, which is a sense of justice.
And sometimes an offense that seems worse from a penal perspective is less for an immigration perspective. Just last week, I don't want to throw anybody under the bus, I'm not even going to say what county I did this in, but I was able to negotiate a plea bargain for a client which actually pled to a worse charge in order to have a lesser immigration consequence. And I don't know if enough attorneys know that those don't necessarily mesh or line up. And those consultations, which I just got one back today from the very person you and I were discussing, those are really critical. You have to know what it is today, because it may have been different 2 months ago.
Absolutely. Complicated feel.
In fact, many times the immigration consequences of a criminal case are far, far more impacting on the person who's got the criminal case himself, as well as his family and the people around him, than the criminal case itself. Isn't that the case, Bill?
Absolutely. I know some individuals who would rather take a prison time than deportation, if it avoids deportation. And so it's to Jeff's point that you might take a plea on a section of the statute that might mean more jail time but it means that you'll avoid deportation. And somebody actually might take that choice.
Let me open it up to Fran from San Francisco. Fran, welcome to Your Legal Rights. You're on the air.
Hi, this is Fran. I heard a question asked about people are being very uptight about going to their court hearings, you know, understandably, right? They don't want to go because they might be arrested by ICE. However, I heard it said that they really should go because if they do not go, they are automatically deportable. So for people who might need to hear this, could you confirm that?
That's right. That if you have a hearing set and you do not show up, the judge often will, in fact, regularly will order you deported in absentia because you didn't show up at a hearing that you received proper notice for. So there is one avenue that is possible, but you need time to do it. You can make a motion to have your hearing done virtually. And so, but you have to get help in preparing the paper. You have to have a good reason for making a motion to have your hearing done virtually. There are some people that are helping some folks do that. And the other hand, we are regularly checking and monitoring whether ICE is at the immigration courts. And so for today, for example, we found out that ICE was not in the immigration court. And so people went and did their appearances, and nobody got arrested.
Bill, can I change the subject a little bit? I'm going to ask you about what's commonly referred to as a U visa. Would you tell us what that is and how that fits into the rest of the scheme of what we're talking about?
Yeah, a U visa is very commonly known in the community as well. A U visa is for somebody who has been a victim of a very serious crime, and usually it involves bodily harm or threat of death. So it has to be something very serious. It cannot be just being defrauded, although it depends on the emotional harm. If you get if you've been a victim of a serious crime and you report it to the police and you're willing to be a witness against the person, if they arrest the person, then you can apply for a U visa. The police department or the district attorney has to certify that you came in good faith and that you were available as a witness, and you can apply for a U visa. The problem is that there's only 10,000 U visas available a year for the whole country, and there's a backlog right now of at least 5 years for that U visa. And we are concerned that people who are applying for U visas are exposing themselves to ICE today, to at least to DHS, and that the arm of DHS that accepts these visas may likely inform ICE that, hey, we've got somebody who just filed a U visa, and the U visa is 5 years off. And we have a little bit of concern that they might get arrested by ICE. That hasn't happened yet, but we have to advise clients of that possibility.
Are they getting a stay of their deportation while the U visa application is pending?
You would think that, but the answer is no. There's no stay of deportation, even though you have a valid visa pending.
And how do the U visa applications fit in with what I commonly refer to as the wife-beating cases?
Well, if you are the victim of domestic violence, you can apply for a U visa or you can apply for a VAWA visa. Under the Violence Against Women Act, there's actually a separate path for victims of domestic violence for lawful permanent residents. In fact, you can self-petition if you are a victim of domestic violence. So there are two different things. And the VAWA visa, you can apply for that. And there's not a backlog in that category.
One of the consequences of applying for a Vala visa might be that there'd be criminal charges brought against the husband. Is that the case?
That is very possible as well, and that's why some victims don't pursue that route because they don't want to get their partner into trouble. But that's something that you advise, and they make the decision.
The husband might get deported then, right?
That has happened, absolutely.
There's a perception that the folks that are here without documents are overwhelmingly from Mexico. And yet you hear from such notables as Angela Davis, who once commented the number of undocumented folks, the number of illegal white immigrants in this country exceed the number of illegals from Latin America. I know at one time it were a very large number of people from Britain that overstayed their visas. Do we know, are there any records kept about how many people from various places and whether the administration is disproportionately focusing on one group?
The Pew Hispanic Center and Migration Policy Institute have demographers that track that information. And one thing is true, that the vast majority of folks that are undocumented in the country are people who did not come across the southern border. The vast majority are people who have overstayed their visas. And that is not who is being targeted. So that's absolutely right, that they may not all be white, but most of the people in the United States that are undocumented are from countries that people came as students or visitors, and they overstayed those visas. But yes, it's true that the vast majority of those people who came across the southern border undocumented, without documents, yeah, they may be from Latin countries, but that is just one issue. The other issue is who overstayed visas, and that is every country in the world. That's Europeans, that's Asians, that's even Canadians, and so that's a good point. That the priority of the Trump administration is not looking at the those folks who overstayed their visas. They're actually looking for folks who they think came across the southern border, and they're clogging up the immigration courts.
Let me turn it over to Peter from Florida. We have just a few minutes for one last call.
Okay, yeah. You reminded me. They can even come to this country and learn how to fly an airplane, not take off or land, but just how to fly an airplane, to bring back some memories. Anyway, no, I was thinking of Miranda.
They were learning their trade in Florida, as I recall.
Yeah, that's my state for the time being. But Miranda, how would things, I was wondering how things would be different today for Ernesto Miranda, for whom, of course, Miranda rights are named for him. He was in this country as an illegal immigrant. And his crime was like rape, assault, and illegal firearms carrying. How would things be varied if you took someone like that, if he did that today, aside from the fact of being read his Miranda rights, what else would be different today as opposed to 1963?
Well, assuming that he had due process in the criminal court system, if he actually pleaded guilty to the crimes that you're laying out, he would be deported.
Well, does Miranda apply in immigration court?
Miranda does not apply in immigration court, so you don't have a right to be informed of the right to counsel in immigration court. You do have a right to an attorney in immigration court, but not at government expense. And so an immigration judge will tell you that, but an ICE agent won't tell you that when you're arrested.
But if the confession is given in violation of Miranda, is it admissible in immigration court?
The exclusionary rule does not apply in removal proceedings. The only time that exclusion can apply is when there's been an extraordinary violation of the Fourth or Fifth Amendment. So it's got to be an egregious violation. It cannot just be a technical violation of the Fourth or Fifth Amendment.
And to our non-lawyers that are listening, when we talk about the exclusionary rule, That simply says that evidence that was intended to be used against you, that was unlawfully seized, probably can't be used in the case against you.
In a criminal proceeding.
But that doesn't apply in immigration proceedings.
Right. And that comes from a case called Lopez Mendoza that was decided in the 1980s. Right.
Lopez Mendoza saying it doesn't apply in immigration proceedings.
Exactly.
Right. We've had it in criminals since the 1950s. And who knows how long it'll be with us before they decide it wasn't such a great idea.
Well, one would hope that the Supreme Court will stand by some basic due process rights.
One would hope. Hope springs eternal. We're out of time, and I wanted to give you, Bill, a minute or so if any thoughts you want to share.
Well, I do want to say that, remind listeners, we're generally not talking about criminals who are being rounded up or people that are being targeted by ICE. They're folks, in my practice anyway, at our clinic at USF, they're folks that have fled violence, and they've been victims of political and gang and cartel violence. And so, and then there are other people that are trying to do well by their family, and they're hardworking folks filling a lot of jobs that many U.S. citizens are not that interested in. And so I just want to make sure that people understand the context that we're not talking about criminals generally. But I can make a case that even somebody convicted of a crime, we should look at what led to that.
And one last thing I wanted to ask you. Is there a centralized number we can give people so that maybe if they find themselves or a family member is getting snatched up, they have some place they can call, maybe find some help?
Well, I would try the San Francisco Bar Association, the Justice and Diversity Center. They're the quarterback of the Immigration Legal Defense Collaborative in the Bay Area. There are also rapid response numbers throughout the Bay Area for if ICE is seen that folks can call, and those are readily found online.
415-989-1616.
That's the Bar Association of San Francisco. They can help you. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. Tonight, we've been talking about immigration, some of the current events, and folks, we've only barely scratched the surface. It's been amazing what's happened in the 2 weeks since we began this broadcast. And discussing it with our guest tonight, Professor Bill Hing from the University of San Francisco School of Law. Tonight's show was produced by David Bigelizen and yours truly. And I want to make a big thanks to tonight's guest, professor, author, activist Bill Hing. And I hope you'll come and join us again soon. And also thank my co-host tonight, David Bigelizen. And thanks to all of you for listening. And at the controls, Joanne Marr, I'm Jeff Hayden. Be safe, good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.